The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. This week, after pouring us an additional $4 trillion in an already heated economy in the beginning of his administration, President Biden is feeling the heat from voters, and Americans are feeling the heat on inflation. President Biden gets testy.
I don't want to hear any more of these lies about reckless spending. We're changing people's lives.
We'll hear from Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton.
So I think you're beginning to see a massive repudiation of the Democrats later this year.
In the face of skyrocketing gas prices, the need for a greater degree of domestic production ought to be self-evident. John Kerry, climate czar under President Biden, is, however, pushing back.
We absolutely don't. And we have to prevent a false narrative from entering into this.
We'll look at Tuesday night's primary, including Nevada GOP nominee for the United States Senate, Adam Laxalt.
This is going to be the key to the Senate.
And Andrew McCarthy looks at the January 6th hearing.
Democrats are trying to take attention away from how bad things are going for Biden.
All this and more. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well, please, at Town Hall Review. We'll begin the week in Washington, and with our president, and an administration that increasingly is tone-deaf to the state of the economy, denying what the profligate spending of Biden's first year, coupled with the move away from energy independence, has done to the average American family. The president was in Philadelphia this week, speaking to a conference of the AFL-CIO, when he essentially chastised the American people.
I don't want to hear any more of these lies about reckless spending. We're changing people's lives.
Mark my words, you'll be hearing that clip a lot through November. Talk radio, conservative media, political ads, even the legacy media has the president essentially yelling at the American people to shut up. I turn to Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton. We can't talk about the inflation numbers, Senator. Joe Biden shut us down yesterday. I'm afraid the FCC will pull my license if we bring up the producer price index going up 0.8% month over month, inflation rolling around at 8.6% year over year. We're just not, I'm shut down. I don't know what to do.
Hugh, Joe Biden was right yesterday that he's changed people's lives. $5 a gallon gas, kids trying to change their gender in school, crime surging in our streets. He's changed a lot of Americans' life, Hugh.
Senator Cotton, what do you see happen? I know you're out campaigning for Republicans. I don't know if you have a pack or not that you're helping people with. Tell us if you do, and where have you been going, and what have you been hearing?
Yeah, well, one place where I've campaigned to you already was in Nevada for Adam Laxalt last summer, and I was very pleased to see Adam win a big victory, and I'm confident that we're going to win back the Nevada Senate seat later this year. Kathy Cortez Masto has voted in lockstep with Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer all year long. The victory in South Texas in the special election was also especially exciting. It continues the surge that we've seen in Latino voting for Republicans, because, again, Latinos don't want to pay $5 a gallon for their gas. They don't want to pay an extra $25 every week at the grocery store. They're worried about crime in their streets, and they're worried about the quality of their kids' education. So I think you're beginning to see what will be a massive, massive repudiation of the Democrats later this year.
So, Senator Cotton, John Kerry said this. He was at USC, which is not exactly the font of all learning. But John Kerry said this, cut number 18.
An energy security worry is driving a lot of the thoughts now about, oh, we need more drilling of gas. We need more drilling of this. We need to go back to coal. No, we don't. We absolutely don't. And we have to prevent a false narrative from entering into this or, again, pun intended, we are cooked.
This is a cult, Senator Cotton. This is nuts. Americans are crushed by gas prices, and the Defense Production Act is being used for baby formula and solar panels, but not for gasoline production. To what do you say to John Kerry, former Secretary of State and now, quote, climate cult czar?
Well, Hugh, the Democrats care more about ideology than they care about your family's budget. That kind of thinking is what got us $5 a gallon gas. And in some states out west, it's almost $10 a gallon gas. Joe Biden wants to use the Defense Production Act, as you said, to produce more solar panels. Well, you know what? Solar panels aren't going to do much to help people when they're paying $5 a gallon for gas. It's not, also not going to do much for our military, and not going to do much for our efforts to support the military in Ukraine. Joe Biden's priorities reflect the diluted ideology of the far left in America today that is detached from your family's concerns and detached from reality.
All right. Now, Senator, I saw the first cut of an Afghan documentary, a documentary about Save Our Allies, about the effort to get people out by retired special force operators during the collapse last year. Made me angry at Joe Biden all over again. And I listened to Tim Kennedy talk about his new book, Scars and Stripes, and about how they went out with special operators to get people beyond the wire. Will there, if the Republicans get the Senate, will there be a look, a serious look at what went wrong in Afghanistan?
Yeah, Hugh, I can assure you there will be that. This administration has been trying to send the debacle in Afghanistan down the memory hole, especially the failures you had at the State Department in terms of planning for the evacuation. But an Armed Services Committee will also be checking it out from the Department of Defense standpoint.
Now, in terms of that, that would require the Armed Services Committee or a select committee? Because I am genuinely convinced Americans are still going to, if they see it in ads, they're going to vote against Democrats because of what happened. And they're not going to buy this was happening because of Donald Trump. They're not going to buy that. They're going to buy it with Joe Biden's plan, his hard deadline. So does the investigation have to go to a select committee or does it go to Armed Services?
Hugh, I think that's something that we'll handle on Armed Services Committee. Again, the real malfeasance was in Joe Biden's White House and the State Department. The State Department is the lead agency for any kind of non-combatant evacuation. They were really asleep at the switch. Obviously, the Department of Defense could have done things differently and probably better in some cases, but we'll be looking into that. And I think what you see right now with $5 a gallon gas, Hugh, was kind of foretold by the debacle in Afghanistan.
When we look at the defense budget, and 5%, I mean, 8.6% inflation, that's hitting every combatant commander. That's hitting every level down. Is defense spending going to increase, at least so we don't get a rolling cut in defense preparedness?
Well, Hugh, you know, Jimmy Carter, after the Shah fell in Iran in 1979 and Russia invaded Afghanistan, was mugged by reality. So the 1980 defense budget was actually a little bit better than his previous three budgets. What we have with Joe Biden in the war in Ukraine and the collapse of Afghanistan is a president who is mugged by reality but refuses to press charges.
Huh?
The budget he submitted doesn't even keep up with his own inflation. I'm hopeful, though, that after the election, the Democrats will be licking their wounds so badly that they simply want to tie a bow on this year's work and that we can get a full year spending bill for the Department of Defense so they can have the kind of certainty they need.
Tuesday night's elections included some results that raised many eyebrows. I'm referring to the special election in Texas' 34th Congressional District. Republican Myra Flores won outright, avoiding a runoff in a special election. That district is 85% Hispanic, an indicator that more and more Hispanics are recognizing that the GOP really is a natural home for them. Also, Nevada held their primary. Adam Laxalt won handily in the GOP Senate primary and will face the invisible senator, Catherine Cortez Masto. Really, you couldn't pick her out of a lineup. Laxalt was a guest on my program. Just give me what you think that race is going to come down to, Adam Laxalt.
Well, look, first and foremost, as people start truly paying attention to control the Senate, everybody's going to understand quickly that it's going to come down to this race. This is the 51st seat, and we have a very, very small map. We've got to hold a lot of Republican seats, and we've got a very few opportunities to flip. And so the good news is every single ratings agency has labeled her the most vulnerable senator in America. We had six consecutive polls where she was at 40, and we were beating her. And they're already spending gobs of money, including a Soros attack ad that's been up for the last many weeks, because they know that this is going to be the key to the Senate, and they know they've got a lot of work to do to dig her out of this hole.
Now, Adam, you're the Attorney General of Nevada. You know what the crime problem and the immigration problem is. Does that matter? And will Senator Cortez Masto even talk to you about it?
Yeah, look, I think this race is going to come down to these two key issues. I mean, there's no question that gas is a massive problem. We're number two in America right now, above Hawaii, if your listeners can believe that we have more expensive gas than a landlocked island. Inflation is number two in the country as well, which amounts to $12,000 a year tax on Nevadans. So those issues, they can't fix. We know the Biden administration are not going to change course, and she is stuck with those issues. But the next two major issues in our state is the border crisis and the law and order issues. And in both areas, she's in huge trouble. She's got the worst border record of any senator up for election this cycle, consistently stood with this open border agenda. And meanwhile, she's lying to voters now, saying that she's a tireless fighter against human trafficking. Well, we all know an open border is one of the main sources of human trafficking. And if she cared about our state, she would about face on that in order to reduce that terrible, terrible crime against children and adults that are being smuggled across the border. So we've got that going on. And, you know, the other big clash is over the overall view of law enforcement. You know, I'm the former top cop of this state. We had a tremendous relationship with law enforcement across Nevada, and she was nowhere to be found. And despite the fact that because she was a former AG, she was able to receive a bunch of law enforcement endorsements in her first Senate race in 16, they have flipped to me for this race.
And now that is a big deal.
Your listeners would understand. I mean, it's an incumbent senator. You know, she's on the committees, et cetera. I mean, this is a big deal when they wake up and say she has not represented law enforcement, and we know that Adam Laxalt will stand with us.
Now, Adam Laxalt, when I was on with Brett Baer talking about this race, I said it has to be killing Las Vegas that gas in California is $6.50 a gallon because people just don't drive the 15 over to Las Vegas. Am I right about that, or was I imagining that?
Look, there's no question that gas is just a massive, massive issue. And we started what we're calling Gas Can Man, and he's visiting the various pockets of Las Vegas where gas is over $6. I mean, it's just so hard to imagine. But she has been an absentee senator, and she's refused to do anything that goes against her left-wing base. And we all know there's a lot of things to be done that could start driving gas prices down today. Instead, she's rolling with the Putin price hike, greedy oil executive con. And, you know, she's still not standing with Nevadans.
Coming up, the House Select Committee's hearing on January 6th.
The left and the Democrats are trying to take attention away from how bad things are going for Biden.
When the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy enters our 25th anniversary year, we've remained committed to a single truth of world history, that ideas have consequences. To understand these ideas and their impact on today's politics, and to test them quantitatively, requires the unique curriculum we offer on our Malibu, California campus. Apply now for fall classes at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The House Select Committee continued hearings on events surrounding January 6th this week. I would not be surprised if you missed it. But the Nancy Pelosi-led House and her colleagues have done something unprecedented. They've conducted a set of hearings on a serious event in our nation's history without letting the minority party appoint members to the committee doing the so-called investigation. That was deeply wrong, corrosive to the trust that is necessary for a free republic. It hurt the Congress especially. Seth Leibson, my colleague on AM 960, The Patriot in Phoenix, turned to Andrew McCarthy.
My mind turned exactly and directly to you because I know that no one has dealt with sedition and those laws as much or as seriously or even as successfully as you. So it's good to get your take on this. In your piece, The Tale of Two Seditions over at The Hill, tell us what you're driving at here, Andy.
Well, you know, I appreciate your reminding people of that, Seth. I did prosecute the last successful big sedition case brought by the Justice Department more years ago than either one of us would like to remember.
It does actually doesn't seem that long ago.
Yeah, 1995, though. Okay. Long ago and far away. But in any event, when the Justice Department, after a long bit of hesitation and a lot of goading from the left over the fact that it hadn't brought insurrection-type charges in connection with the Capitol riot, they were finally, I thought, goaded into indicting a seditious conspiracy case. And I thought it was a terrible mistake because not that I think they're innocent. I think there's plenty of charges that you could bring, like obstruction of a congressional proceeding and assaulting police officers that would provide for decades if you needed it of penal exposure, potentially. So I didn't think they needed the 20-year seditious conspiracy sentence. And I thought conceptually it hurts their case because the seditious conspiracy statute has been on the books since the Civil War.
Right.
The 1862 statute is intended mainly for anti-union saboteurs in a number of the states. And the reason I thought it was a mistake for them is because we've never had a case in the history of our country with a statute that's been on the books now for almost two centuries.
Mm-hmm.
Where the defendants could plausibly claim that they were acting at the behest of the president of the United States. You have to prove in connection with the crime that they intended to make war on the United States or oppose the government's authority by force. And these guys will be able to claim that they thought that the president was calling them out like militias, and they were trying to save the United States from people who were trying to steal the election. Now, I'm not getting into whether that's all true, because
sure.
It doesn't matter. What
right.
matters is they believed it.
Right.
So their intent is what matters in a criminal proceeding. So I've taken perverse pleasure in the fact that since I've written that, they've taken some pleas in this case. And the interesting thing is when you see the statement of facts that the Justice Department is having them admit to, the only way they're able to pull off this case is to stay a million miles away from Trump.
Right.
So basically what they argue is basically that Trump is like a tangential figure who had very little to do with January 6th.
Right.
And he's really, in their minds, a pretext for things that the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers would have done anyway.
Right. So this is the real odd thing.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
I don't think the Justice Department is going to get far with that theory if they have to actually try this case.
Yeah.
I can see how they can get guilty pleas because people, at this point, a guilty plea with cooperation is what gets you out from under a long sentence.
So right.
If they ask them to plead to, you know, wearing a clown suit on Fifth Avenue, that's what they plead to, right? So
mm-hmm.
Sedition, you know, whatever. Fine, I'm guilty. But if they have to try this case, I think they're going to have trouble.
The Department of Justice is trying to avoid a nexus to Donald Trump's, inspiration, cause, catalyzing of the events, while the January 6th committee at the House of Representatives is trying to do the exact opposite. And if I am right, the Department of Justice isn't doing it because you can't have the president committing sedition against his own office, I suppose.
Yeah, that would be a tough one.
Okay. I
mean, it'd be very,
all right. But I'm following the logic, right? Yeah?
Right. Yeah, no, you absolutely are. So the Justice Department doesn't want to put this in because it's the defense.
Right.
Right. You know, so they don't want to say, they don't want to have a charging instrument that says that the president directed people to attack Congress because the president said the election was being stolen because
right.
their defense then is, we weren't making war in the United States. We're trying to save the
right,
United States.
Right, right, right.
So, but the and of course, if you look at the Justice Department indictment, Seth, Trump is not named as a defendant. He's not named as an unindicted co-conspirator. And the clear reason for that is they don't have a shred of evidence that there was a meeting of the minds between Trump and the Oath Keepers.
Right.
According
to the Department of Justice, he is legally further away from the January 6th melee or riot than Nixon was from Watergate.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Nixon was, yeah, okay, all right. Nixon was closer to the Watergate break-in than Donald Trump was to the House of Representatives break-in.
Yes, because
okay.
with Nixon, he knowingly, tried to help them after they did right?
Yeah, yeah, so, and he was listed, I think he was put down as an unindicted co-conspirator, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I don't remember that, although I don't remember if he ever tweeted that they were really beautiful people.
Okay, all right. Let's one of the things I did want to ask you is the January 6th committee, as you've been following it, whether formally, informally, or otherwise, as you've been watching it unfold, I guess is the way to put it, is the January 6th committee effort at this point trying to just find guilt and complicity of Donald Trump? Is that what this is all about? Because I have to tell you, it seems to me, if that's all they have been trying to do, they should have been able to have done that by now. If that is under this pile of manure, if that exists, it seems to me that should have been done by now. Because I don't understand how you have hearings about something after all the indictments and arrests have been made. It usually goes the other way. Iran-Contra hearings, then arrests and indictments. Same with other scandals.
Yeah. I don't think there's one answer to this because there's too many different players. In a nutshell, what I would say is, if it's to be properly understood, it's an attempt to do the impeachment investigation that the Congress was derelict in doing in January of 2021.
That's what it sounds an awful lot like that same case. It just sounds like the same argument. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, not only that, Seth, there's no, a congressional committee is not a grand jury or a federal prosecutor. Prosecution and criminal investigation in our system are executive.
Right.
The only time Congress has real constitutional jurisdiction to investigate is when they're investigating high crimes and misdemeanors.
Right.
So to do what they're doing properly, I think they should transparently say that they're an impeachment committee.
Right.
Because that would make a lot more sense. But they don't want to do that. And I think, just quickly, I think the left and the Democrats are trying to take attention away from how bad things are going for Biden. I mean, they could have done this, as you point out, they could have done this any time. They picked now to do it. And, but at this point, Trump's been out of office for, a year and a half, and he can't affect events. So what's the point of doing this other than to attract attention? And I think Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger really think that Trump is terrible for the Republican Party and that
They're just trying to clean the Augean stables. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what's going on. Well, so I think there's all different motivations going on, but I think one of the real reasons the Democrats are doing it is the left really wants it.
Coming up, the climate cult, the energy crisis, and the fight for our energy future.
The basic thing that people don't get is that there's no scalable way to replace gasoline cars with EVs.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Stay with it.
This is jaw-dropping.
2,000 Mules, a shocking new movie from Dinesh D'Souza. Cell phone geo-tracking tells the truth behind the 2020 election conspiracy.
Philadelphia alone, we've identified more than 1,100 mules. This is organized crime.
They have ruined Election Day in the United States of America. That's provable.
See the proof for yourself. 2,000 Mules. Watch it or buy it today at SalemNow.com. That's SalemNow.com. 2,000 Mules. Executive produced by Salem Media Group.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. In the later years of President Donald Trump's term, he and his entire administration boasted, rightly, of America's hard-fought-for and won energy independence. The average gas price was $2.17 a gallon. All of that, our energy independence, the reasonable prices at the pump, it was willfully relinquished by President Biden. And now he and his team, the Biden team, do not want to turn back. Back President Biden's climate czar, former Secretary of State John Kerry, made it clear as gas prices have continued to soar.
President Biden has made a very significant commitment for the United States to be, first of all, power sector carbon free by 2035, to only be producing electric vehicles in the United States, which General Motors and Ford and others manufacturing have bought into. and they're now spending hundreds of millions of dollars to retool their plants in order to produce those vehicles.
I've called it a climate cult. Alex Epstein is pushing back against this movement, which he sees as increasingly religious. He's the author of Fossil Future: Why Global Human Flourishing Requires More Oil, Coal, and Natural Gas, Not Less. He was a guest of my friend, Dennis Prager.
I just read a report that it's going to be so long before we can actually transition to what is called a green energy world. Are you familiar with this latest report of saying that?
What's basically happened is there's been this mythology. There's sort of two ideas behind we should rapidly eliminate fossil fuels. One is they're causing this climate catastrophe that will become an apocalypse. Number two is that they're rapidly replaceable by so-called renewables, mainly solar and wind. And what we've seen is all these countries have invested huge amounts in these renewables. They've given them huge favoritism, and they've restricted fossil fuel investment, production, and transportation on the lie that these unreliable renewables would replace them, and it's failed. And so now we're short of fossil fuels, and we have a global energy crisis. And so the idea that, oh, now it's going to work to rapidly replace them is even delusional people are not as deluded anymore.
Really? That's happy to hear. GM announced that by 2030, it will not be producing anything except electric cars. A, do you believe that's true? B, why are they doing it?
I doubt it's true. I mean, of course, Tesla only produces battery cars, so it's possible to be such a manufacturer. I mean, I think the basic thing that people don't get is that there's no scalable way to replace gasoline cars with EVs. And so you can have some minority of people doing it, but if everyone tries to do it, you're going to run into massive shortages of all the raw materials. We're already having skyrocketing lithium prices at a tiny scale of EVs. So why are they doing this? I think a combination of status, trying to anticipate future government mandates. And I think they probably haven't thought through the scalability issues. I doubt Mary Barra has fully, I think that's who runs GM, has fully thought through these issues.
What does a scalability issue mean?
So a scalability issue means how do you produce something at a given price or a lower price on a much larger scale? And one thing that all of these green things have in common is they involve many multiples times more basic elements than we're using today. So lithium is an example where people are talking about we need 100, 1,000 times more lithium. We never have that kind of scaling and keeping the cost low. And we're already seeing with a modest amount of scaling that the cost is going sky high. So whenever you impose a very artificial crash timetable on the market, you get these drastic price increases, which these people are not factoring in.
So I'm going to ask you another question related to the electric car. It might be just a very simplistic, not just simple question, but I don't care. I don't know the answer, so I'm asking you. Since we're already experiencing, you and I both live in California, we're already experiencing brownouts almost every summer where simply the electricity dies for a certain number of hours in one of the most advanced democracies in the history of the world. And rich, and one of the richest, and this is happening as well in Germany. So where is all the electricity going to come from to power all these cars?
It's unfortunately not a dumb question or a naive question. It's a question that people haven't really thought through. And one of my big points in Fossil Future is this idea that we're going to rapidly replace fossil fuels is not a really thought through idea by people with a real plan. Otherwise, they would just compete on the market and perform. It's by people with a deep hostility toward energy, not just fossil fuels, but also nuclear and hydro, who are just looking for a rationalization. So they say, yeah, okay, we'll build solar and wind. Don't worry about us getting rid of fossil fuels. Don't worry about shutting down the pipeline. Don't worry about banning leasing on federal lands because we have this magical solution. And then you look at the details and it's like, you haven't thought this through at all because you're already making electricity more expensive, more scarce, less reliable. And then you're massively going to increase the demand based on EVs. So there's no real thinking going on here. It's just rationalizing an agenda of eliminating our mainstream energy use, which is really, I argue, about eliminating human impact on Earth.
Coming up.
And so what you see is the common denominator in this anti-fossil fuel movement is not a concern about fossil fuels. It's a hostility toward all forms of energy.
More Alex Epstein when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
2,000 Mules is the number one selling documentary of the decade, and it's making a difference. In a recent Rasmussen poll, 68% of Democrats and 77% of unaffiliated voters who saw the movie now believe widespread fraud did happen in the 2020 elections. Share the truth with friends and family. Buy 10 or more DVDs or downloads. Get 20% off at SalemNow.com. That's SalemNow.com. 2,000 Mules. Executive produced by Salem Media Group.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Americans are coming to grips with the fact that the environmental left, the climate cult, as I've called it, is not really about a forward-looking plan to help humanity prosper in a future without fossil fuels. How do you know? Well, they never talk about nuclear power, for example. That's part of their cannot-do list as well. In fact, with control of both chambers of Congress and the presidency as well, the environmental elites in today's Democratic Party have had an opportunity to let their agenda play out. And humanity has not been helped. Let's pick up on Dennis's conversation with Alex Epstein, author of Fossil Future, where he argues that the environmental movement really has an anti-human aspect to it.
Why do you argue that? I know that's a big theme of yours, so elaborate.
So the easy thing to think is that the anti-fossil fuel movement is just really focused on CO2 emissions. And they're just so concerned that our rising CO2 levels that we've caused by our CO2 emissions from fossil fuels, that that's making the world a bad place. But we see, wait a second, they also oppose nuclear, which is the most promising and proven alternative to fossil fuels. They oppose hydro, which is the next one after that. And then with solar, wind, and batteries, they oppose mining, which needs to be scaled up massively. And they oppose massive amounts of development, which are needed for transmission lines and for building the things. And so what you see is the common denominator in this anti-fossil fuel movement is not a concern about fossil fuels. It's a hostility toward all forms of energy because all forms of energy involve impacting nature. And the core thing I say about this in Fossil Futures, the goal that's animating the green movement and in diluted form much of the population is not advancing human flourishing on Earth, but eliminating human impact on Earth. But the deep hostility toward human life,
that's new.
This is something you see emerging. Yeah, I mean, you see it with Rousseau. You see it with a lot of the people who have resentment over the successes of industrialization. I think there's a lot of envy there. And a lot of people like the idea that human impact is bad because even though it makes them bad, it makes us worse.
Alex Epstein knows a tremendous amount, but he understands a tremendous amount. The animating impulse, you've really explained it well, is the opposite of human flourishing. It's like between the contest of nature and humans, they're rooting for nature. And now you have, by the way, it's very interesting. You're the founder of the Center for Industrial Progress, but your project is the Human Flourishing Project, correct?
It's a podcast of mine.
And what is the name of the podcast?
It's called the Human Flourishing Project. And the basic idea is human flourishing is the theme of my work on energy, but I like studying it in other areas. So I have a podcast where I discuss it in other areas.
Give me an example of another area.
Well, a big area that I focus on is actually our creative and productive life. I'm a big fan of what I call relaxed productivity, which is the idea that we should produce tremendous amounts of value, but really enjoy the process instead of just being stressed by it all the time. And it's something I plan to write a book on at some point in the not too distant future. And so that's kind of, I think, one key aspect of flourishing that's misunderstood is that productive work can really make you happy, but it has to be approached a certain way. And I think, you know, you study a lot of these kinds of things on the Happiness Hour, which is, you know, my favorite part of your show. And I'm very interested in these kinds of issues, and I integrate them all under human flourishing.
I love it. I love the name of the podcast. Is that how people find you? They just type in Human Flourishing Project?
Yeah, if you just type it in on Apple. I've been a little bit delinquent in new episodes, but I think there are 98 episodes, so you got plenty
to
catch
up on. So you could binge watch for a while. Yes, exactly. This the book is Fossil Future, Why Global Human Flourishing Requires More Oil, etc. Unfortunately, China agrees with you. That's the irony. And so while we and Germany and other countries start impoverishing ourselves and pushing ourselves into terrible inflation over energy, they're increasing their use of coal, for example. Is that correct?
Yeah, for sure. This is one of the big motivations for me to write the book is we're not going to pursue global net zero. That's not a realistic possibility. What is a realistic possibility is what I call unilateral disempowerment. So disempowerment means going from a state of empowerment, which means you have cost-effective energy in modern life, to a state where you have less of it or none of it. So a place that has been disempowered as Venezuela, you know, primarily by socialism. And what's happening in the U.S. is we're foregoing fossil fuels. We're trying to forego nuclear. To some extent, we have hostility toward hydro. We're supposedly trying to replace them with unreliable solar and wind, but even those have opposition. And what's happening is, so we are disempowering while China is empowering with an explicit goal of world domination by 2049. And mind you, they control the entire supply chain for green energy, which is something that people don't think about when they talk about our dependence on fossil fuels. That's nothing compared to our dependence on China for solar panels, wind turbines, and batteries, which even if they were cost effective, which they're not for producing electricity on a large scale, they would be disastrously dependent on China's whims and manipulation.
Wow. I was thinking the other day about this. If there were not even a military conflict, but an economic war with China, the amount that we are dependent upon China. I mean, somebody told me just recently, we get our vitamin C from China. So your point is not new to me, but I didn't realize even the green world is dependent upon.
Especially the green world.
But here's the kicker. Especially the green world is dependent upon China, which is completely okay with being dependent on coal.
Yeah, and so that's part of the fallacy of green energy is it involves, you know, Chinese coal, Chinese slave labor, Chinese low environmental standards. And so it's part of the reason why I say it's not a serious attempt at energy. It's just a rationalization for people who have hostility toward energy in general, and then human impact in general.
That's exactly right. So explain this. I think you have alluded, I know you've alluded to it. So I believe France gets 60% of its energy from nuclear power.
Electricity.
Sorry?
Electricity, not energy.
Good,
just
thank
it's
you.
Electricity,
it's electricity.
That,
thank you. Where does it get its energy from?
Well, oil.
So
I mean,
it's
a lot of oil.
Where is it getting its oil from? That's what I meant.
Oh, I don't know exactly where they're importing
okay,
it from.
All right,
but,
fine.
You know, they banned fracking.
So they banned fracking. That's fascinating.
Coming up.
There's a deep, like, hatred of humanity, and I think a lot of it is envy-driven. Some human beings who feel inferior like ideas that make their superiors inferior.
A few more minutes with Alex Epstein and Fossil Future in the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt.
Hi, I'm Don Crow. This week in the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, a deeper look at one of the classic works of C.S. Lewis.
First of all, I would claim that if you want to know C.S. Lewis, you must know this book.
From a writer who has been shaped by Lewis and by this particular book for decades.
I don't read fluently Italian, but I read more than one translation of Dante, and the glory of the end matches the glory of Dante's achievement in the Paradiso at the end. That's how wonderful this is.
We'll get a deep look at what Lewis himself described as the favorite of his books.
I really do think this is one of the great modern epics in English.
James Como joins us for a special edition of our program. We have all this and more. Be sure to join us and visit our website at christianoutlook.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The contemporary effort to go green with renewable energy sources, of course, is not unique to the United States. Alex Epstein and Dennis Prager turn to Europe in their conversation on the book, Fossil Future.
So 60% of the electricity of France is nuclear. Why did Germany destroy or abandon its nuclear power?
Well, I think largely because of this lie that unreliable solar and wind could rapidly replace reliable fossil fuels as well as nuclear and hydro.
Right. That's right.
So they felt like we can get some status in the wake of Fukushima, which killed nobody by radiation by shutting down our nuclear plants.
So they really, they've bought the nonsense that you could depend on solar and wind.
Yeah, although interestingly, you know, one of their major power sources that's unheralded is they use wood pellets, often coming, I think, from the U.S. At least Europe uses a lot of this to hit their targets. Europe uses a lot of wood that we chop down using oil, transport using oil, and then they burn it with a lot of emissions, and they call it renewable and pretend it's solar and wind.
Would you say environmentalism, I mean, not the idea that we should be concerned with the environment, just environmentalism, is a secular religion?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I mean, I don't even think it deserves to be called secular, but I think it's a primitive anti-human religion. And the concern with the environment, I think, is a vague way that they want us to think about it. It's really a belief that we should sacrifice to the non-human.
Which is nature.
The rest of nature, though. I think of we're the best part of nature. So it's really a hatred of the human part of nature.
So it's a fascinating thing about the left. They, most of these people are overwhelmingly the heads of the environmentalist activist movements are white. They're generally rich. So they hate themselves for being white, and they hate themselves for being human. There's something very sick going on.
It is very sick. And, you know, Douglas Murray has this new book, The War on the West, which I thought was really good. And he really identifies how the hostility toward the West is not about the things they say, because racism is much worse other places. Slavery was much worse other places. There's a deep, like, hatred of humanity. And I think a lot of it is envy driven. Some human beings who feel inferior like the idea, like ideas that make their superiors inferior.
That's the Israel test of George Gilder.
Interesting.
Yes. Test yourself how you react to those who are more successful than you. Do you resent and hate them, or do you want to emulate them? To him, that is the ultimate human test.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer David Pouchon, Michael Cook, Tim Gantner, Adam Ramsey, Jacob Wardunia, and of course, Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.